This is John Verveke.
This is Simon Essler.
Hi, it's Heather Prozac.
This is Tom Luongo.
This is Alex Craner.
This is Steve Kirsch.
This is Dr. Pierre Corey, and you are listening to the Sean Newman Podcast.
Welcome to the podcast, folks. Happy Friday. We have one on tap for you today. At the start of the year, January 2023, I wrote out a list of 10 names I'd like to get. And one of the 10 names was Martin Armstrong. So, you know, if you'd looked at the list, you might have been like, maybe you knew exactly who that was. Maybe you didn't. But I was like, the chances, I went lofty. I was like, I don't think I'll get these people. And of course, when I got the word back that I was getting Martin Armstrong, I was like, holy shit, right? Like, there's no easier way to say it than like, I'm like, holy mackinaw, here we go. And let me tell you, you better buckle up for this one. There's a lot in it. And I'm not going to hold you up anymore. I know everybody's just itching now. Oh, man. Here we go. Friday. So let's get to today's episode sponsors, all right? Rectech Power Products. For the past 20 years, they've been committed to excellence in the power sports industry. They offer a full lineup, including Can-Am, Ski-Doo, Sea-Doo, Spyder, Mercury, Evinrude, Mahindra, Roxer, the old Sea-Doo, pontoon boat. Man, I don't know where that went. I had to think about that for a second. It's in the showroom. I've been bugging Alan. I'm like, come on, let's take it for a ride. Come on. It's summertime. I'm leaving for holidays. I guess it's doing too much at the showroom. So if you have no idea what the heck I'm talking about, make sure you stop into Rectech on the west side of Lloydminster and to see what they're talking about. It's a super slick. If you're into pontoon boats, super cool layout, super cool feel to it. And you can see it firsthand in the showroom at Rectech, or just go online and you get the point. They got a parts department that can hook you up with any upgrades or odds and ends in the maintenance. Odds and ends and maintenance. Man alive, Sean. Here we go. I am fired up for a Friday. I can't even read my lines. Open Monday through Saturday. And for further details, visit them at rectechpowerproducts.com. Kristen and team over at McGowan Professional Chartered Accountants. If you are a small business looking for somebody to take care of your books, so somebody who enjoys their job. Kristen and the team, I walked in there and threw them a stack of just absolute absurdity. I'm like, here, have fun. And I'm like, I don't even feel bad because they're smiling like, yeah, this is what we do. I'm like, all right, have fun because I don't want to touch that stack of paper with a 10-foot pole. And of course, they're also looking for, they're looking to hire a CPA and would really love to grab somebody here local who understands the industries and their clients in our community. And she's offering an amazing opportunity, above average wages, flex time, benefits, and partnership opportunity. So for more information, if you're looking to get into McGowan CPA, go to mcgowancpa.ca. Ignite Distribution out of Wainwright, Alberta. They can supply automotive, industrial safety, welding parts. Of course, they also do on-site inventory management. I don't know of a business guy that wants to, you know, it's kind of like me and my paper. And it's like, can you just take care of this? Like, honestly, you smiling when you're doing this? It's like, you know, who wants to keep track of every little nook and cranny that makes your business roll? I mean, some people are that detail-oriented. Some of us are like, no chance. Well, Shane Stafford and the team, they can make sure that they do on-site inventory management to make sure you never run out of whatever it is that you need to make sure you run. Give them a call, 780-842-3433. We have the Patreon account is back up. I just released my first video this week. There's going to be more. There's going to be some behind-the-scenes stuff. And, if you're interested in supporting the podcast, obviously it's Patreon's a paywall, so I don't want to mislead you there. And then the hope is, like I say, I was talking to Tom Luongo. He's like, I think you need to try it again. I'm like, all right. Tom says it, you know. Let's do it. So Sean started the Patreon back up. He's going to be trying to release here through the summertime some behind-the-scenes stuff for the podcast to kind of keep you in the loop. If you want to go support that, head on, click on the Patreon link in the show notes. Would love to have your support. If not, that's totally cool too. And always appreciate all your guys' feedback through the text line and tuning in each and every week. So we'll... With all that said, let's get onto the tail of the tape. Brought to you by Hancock Petroleum. For the past 80 years, they've been an industry leader in bulk fuels, lubricants, methanol, and chemicals, delivering to your farm, commercial, or oil field locations. For more information, visit them at hancockpetroleum.ca. He's the CEO of Armstrong Economics. His advice has been sought by numerous governments with regards to the global economy, from China to even testifying before Congress. He's the developer of the economic confidence model based on business cycles and best known for calling the crash of 1987. I'm talking about Martin Armstrong. So buckle up. Here we go.
My name is Martin Armstrong, and you're listening to the Sean Newman Podcast.
Well, welcome to the Sean Newman Podcast. Today, I'm joined by Martin Armstrong. So first off, sir, thanks for doing this.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
I'm going to tell you a little story because I'm like a lot of people that sit across from Martin, but I'm going to rewind the clock on Sean's story a little bit, go back to the year of 2020. And my brother invited me to Michael Campbell's World Outlook Financial Conference for the first time. I had three kids under the age of four, and I'd never heard of this guy named Martin Armstrong. And my brothers were like, you got to listen to this guy. So anyways, you come on, and I can't remember everything you said, but you made an impression. And I did what most people, I think, when people make an impression, like, who is this guy? And so I went to Wikipedia. And I'll share this. You know, in the last 3 years, I've certainly learned a lot. But here's what Wikipedia said. He is an American self-taught economic forecaster and convicted felon who spent 11 years in jail for cheating investors out of $700 million and hiding $15 million in assets from regulators. And my initial thought was, why does Michael Campbell have a guy like that talking? And then I fast forward for the last 3 years. I've interviewed a lot of people, Martin, and I see what they want us to all believe of Martin. And I'm curious, to start it off, if Martin wouldn't mind sharing a little bit of his story from his perspective so we can get some of the truth, because certainly over the last 3 years, from my eyes, I've heard a lot, seen a lot, talked to a lot of different people that they don't want saying anything.
Well, Wikipedia is basically controlled by the government anyhow. Many people have tried changing that page, and you know, they always revert it back. Effectively, what it boiled down to was that the Republic National Bank, Edmund Safra, maybe to give him the benefit of the doubt, he stole basically the $1 billion from it and ended up having to plead guilty and pay back all the clients. I didn't owe anything. But to give him the benefit of the doubt, the Japanese government had sent over a letter and said, please confirm that he has $10 billion on deposit at your bank. And there was one there. But they had asked me to bring over $10 billion because they wanted me to invest in Russia with them. And basically what they were doing back then was trying to take over Russia, grab all the natural resources, et cetera. And I rejected it. I said, I'm not investing anything in there. But they had asked me to bring over $10 billion. So perhaps when this letter came, maybe they thought I took the $10 billion, told them it was there, and it wasn't. I don't know. But they then ran to the government and said, gee, we don't know where that money is, which would have made sense if we're talking about the $10 billion. So somebody in the Federal Reserve went back to Japan and said, please confirm $10 billion. Because, I mean, back then it used to be a lot of money. I mean, now we're in the trillions, you know. Back then, that's what the entire bank was being sold for. And they said, oh, so sorry, decimal place error, $1 billion. Well, now he had already taken the $1 billion thinking that he could get away with it. So then that's where it started. The government says, oh, $1 billion is missing, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then when I told them, I said, the bank took the money. What are you people, stupid? You know, I mean, we're not talking about how does $1 billion leave a bank and there's no trace. I mean, it's either got to be a wire, you write a check, something. But, you know, the problem with the law is you're seeing with Trump, et cetera. I mean, these prosecutors get to make these decisions themselves. And they tend to look at it, they're going to become the next president of the United States if they take somebody down famous. Like Giuliani took down John Gotti, you know, Christie went in Jersey. This is how they rise in the political ladder. And so that's basically what happens. I went to my clients and I said, look, the bank took the money. You better come over here and file suits against the bank or you're not going to see a dime. The government went to my clients and nobody would sign a complaint against me. They didn't even understand currency because everything was in yen. And back then, the yen had gone from 75 to the dollar to 147. So if you had given me $1 million worth of yen in 1995, and I've repaid you back the same amount of yen in 1998, it only cost me $500,000. All right. So they went to them and said, oh, he looked at it in dollars. Oh, see, he cheated you. And they said, no, we're fine. What are you talking about? And so then that turned into I manipulated the world economy to make them think they made money, you know, because nobody would sign a complaint against me. And then when they finally figured out that the bank stole the money only because my clients came and they filed suit against the bank, they couldn't hide it anymore. So the bank pled guilty. The bankers got a deal that if they paid everybody back and were made whole, then nobody went to prison. And that's what they did. Not anybody that tries to put that, you know, that the bank even pled guilty on Wikipedia, they take it out immediately. I mean, because that's what they don't want to admit what really took place. So I had actually just recently put out a book, The Plot to Seize Russia, which basically goes into the whole thing. What was really going on is to take over Russia back then, and they wanted me to put in $10 billion into this Hermitage Capital. And the outright scheme was they blackmailed Yeltsin, who was going to run for election in 2000. And they wanted him to put in Barishnovsky, which was their puppet. And when Yeltsin refused, then they set up a sting operation. And they got got him to wire $7 billion from IMF loans to a company to refurbish the Kremlin in Switzerland. And as soon as that took place, then they ran to the government and said, oh, Bank of New York just did a major $7 billion money laundering. So when they ran into the Bank of New York, then they told Yeltsin, you either step down or this is all going to come out. And that's when he realized that he had been set up. And that's how Putin came to power.
What year is this, Martin?
This is 1999. And so he turned to Putin. Mainly because people don't realize, because that's also a lot of propaganda about Putin as well. He turned to Putin because he was not a communist and he wasn't one of the oligarchs. The communists in Russia, they filed a motion for impeachment to try and get rid of Yeltsin. And then they would have taken the country back to the USSR. So Yeltsin turned to Putin, who nobody knew at the time. In the book I put out, I've got all the declassified documents from the Clinton administration all confirming this. And basically, his last words to Putin was protect Russia, because he knew the Americans were invading in the election. And then you had the communists trying to seize the country from the other side. And that's why Hillary started the whole Russian, you know, propaganda stuff, saying that, oh, you know, Putin interfered in the U.S. election because she thought it was retaliation because she was behind the one in 2000. So it just became a real mess. And that's why the government tries to make sure that my Wikipedia page doesn't mention any of the truth about anything else, you know. I mean, but that's what's going on in everything now. I mean, You know, they censoring people. You know, it's just, it's outrageous.
Well, it's like I say, I think a lot of us have had quite the curriculum over the past, you know, the education over the last 3 years. It's been a wild, wild ride. I was wondering if you could talk about Socrates and the pi cycle of 8.6 years.
Well, basically, when I was doing some research, I stumbled upon a list of panics. And it covered a period of 224 years, and there were 26, you know, panics in there listed between 1683 to 1907. So I just took an average, and it turned out to be 8.6. And I plotted out. I thought it was just an average. That was it. And it, when I started plotting it out, it was quite amazing how the economy was actually peaking and bottoming right on the day. I never expected that to actually happen. And the largely what it turned out to be was 8.6 was, you know, of that cycle turned out to be 3,145 days, which was pi. And maybe that explained why it was always consistent. I mean, the very day it picked the 1987 crash is the very day that the peaked in the real estate in 2007. They were even calling it on the floor Armstrong's Revenge. I mean, it's you go back. I mean, it picked the exact day of 9/11. Even the very day that Hitler was offered the chancellorship back in 39. I mean, you know, there is a lot more hidden order to all of this than we perhaps want to entertain. We're always told everything's random. And I mean, I remember in going to school, and when I went to economics class, they said, oh, you can't really predict the future because the business, it's random. And therefore, we can manipulate society because that's what they want to do. Then you went to physics class and they said, nothing's random. You know, I said, one of you guys are lying, you know, and that's basically what really happened. So you find out that most of the academic position on these things is that, oh, it's random, so they can manipulate. And they don't want to talk about the business cycle being definitive or anything of that nature. I mean, even Paul Volcker eventually came out and said, look, the business cycle is about 8 years, period. Many people have come out and have basically looked at this and it said there is a definitive business cycle to this. And there's a lot more involved in it from everything from climate to you name it. I mean, but that's also why there is no government that has ever lasted. There's a cycle to absolutely everything. You know, the Republicans get in, then they get thrown out, the Democrats come in, and it goes back and forth. So, I mean, this is just simply the way it is. Most people in politics, you know, they do realize there's a cycle and they win and they lose and they go back and forth. I had met with Dick Armey, who was the head of the Republicans, and there was a movement for tax reform back then. And he said, I can't support getting rid of the income tax without a constitutional amendment. He says, otherwise they will end up, you know, when the Democrats get back in, and he said to me, you know, cycles, and they will have both a retail sales tax and an income tax. So, and I said, Dick, I know you're right. That's it. But so anything you look at, it's always this. I mean, you take, our model has been projecting an upheaval where government, we're at the end of this phase of what we would call republicanism. the last time we overthrew monarchy. And these cycles come by. We go back and forth between the different types of government. This time, you know, it's going to be Republican forms of government that collapse. And then we get, hopefully, a shot at reforming things and making it more of a direct democracy. But, I mean, they called it, we live in a democracy, but that's just propaganda, too. I mean, do you have a right to vote on anything? Do we go to war? No. I mean, shall we be drafted? No. They just, you know, we have representative form of government, which is really a republic. So they make the decisions. We have no right to vote on any of this stuff. Do you vote, say yes, increase my taxes, please? I mean, you know, it's yet they stand up and say, oh, we're fighting for democracy. That's total, absolute nonsense. We do not live in a democracy. So, I mean, these are different forms of government.
Could you inform the listener? I was mentioning you were coming on, and I was rather excited. And people know who Martin is; they were excited as well. But there's a lot of people who don't understand some of the backstory of Socrates and the model that's giving you some of the insights. And you know, you talk about the pi cycle and just like stumbling upon like, holy crap, this is interesting, right? Like this is beyond interesting, Marty. When did you first create Socrates? And what were the first, like, what was maybe the first thing that you're like, this won't happen? Like, I mean, maybe it will, but I don't know. Maybe I'm a little bit off and, you know, maybe this is a little too much wishful thinking. And then it happens and you're like, holy crap.
Well, I created it back in the 70s. I mean, I had, my father was a lawyer. He wanted, you know, pushing me into law school. And I really just didn't want to become a lawyer. I liked trading, but he said, no, you really shouldn't do that. It's not like a respectable trade or something. And so he pushed me into computers. So I went into computers. I did the whole engineering thing, electrical engineering, programming, everything. And I was just the youngest guy. I mean, so the married guys were getting offered, you know, London, Paris. I was offered, you know, basically Thule, Greenland, Guam, or Vietnam. So I said, no, I don't want that. And they said, first it started as, you know, you can volunteer. Then I said, I don't want to volunteer for any of them. I don't like cold. I'm going to get a sweat off or I'm going to get shot at. You know, what kind of a choice is that? And then it turned into, well, this is, you have to choose one. And then I quit. That was basically it. And I went back to trading. So when I went to trading, because I had the computer skills, I said, gee, I can make a computer to do this. And that's what I did. The first time I would say I really used it was probably 1976. It basically came out and said we're going to have a major inflationary wave. Gold had just dropped from about $200 to $100. And so I actually had signed a lease for 10 years at that time. And back then they had CPI clauses, etc. So I said, look, everybody says inflation is not coming back. So I'll take it. I'll sign personally, but no CPI clause. And they took it out. And my accountant said, well, are you crazy? You're doing this personally. I said, Harold, I'm going with this thing. And, you know, by 1980, they had me in court trying to get me, you know, saying, well, I didn't shovel to the sidewalk to try and get out of that lease. But, you know, then I would say fortunately, that list that I used, the very first date was 1683, which was when the Turks, you know, went in to invade in Austria, in Vienna. That was the financial capital of the world at that time, the Holy Roman Empire. So the list actually was covering international events, not just the United States. And so it basically had picked in 1980, it came out with a forecast, which I did not believe. I thought it was nuts. It said that Britain was going to diverge from Europe, was going to align more with Canada and the United States. The British pound, which was trading at 240, it projected that it would fall to par. I said, what? I said, flipping an economy and all that? And I said, it can't be right. And it was correct. The pound fell from 240 to 103 in 1985. And when I really investigated, that's when I basically got into natural language. That I said, I got to be able to talk to this thing. You know, how are you coming up with this? And it picked up that the North Sea oil had just begun in 1977. And that was changing the whole capital flows and the economic makeup of Britain. Suddenly it was an energy producer rather than a consumer. So it lined up more with the United States and Canada against Europe, which had to import everything. So it was very interesting to see over the years how it's just checking absolutely everything. I became an international hedge fund manager, and probably one of the very first ones, actually, because most of my clients were from overseas. And I saw basically how everything was really moving. In 1985, I had offices in Geneva, and I saw the capital moving. We were all dealing with the OPEC countries back then. And the money and the talent started to move towards Japan. And by 1987, I ended up opening up in Japan and went over there. And I was shocked how many clients we had. And it was just, and then the Japanese economy peaked out in 1989. Then it went from there to Southeast Asia. So I basically did a model that would look at all the capital flows and how everything moved, because the money moved and the talent moved. And it got into, it began to teach me even how it was predicting war. We had a client in Lebanon, Universal Bank of Lebanon. And they had found a ledger in their basement where somebody wrote down the Lebanese pound every day and asked us if we could build a model on Lebanese pound. I said, sure, send it over and we'll put it in and see what comes out. And what came out, I thought it was wrong. It said, your country's going to fall apart in 8 days. And I called them. I said, look, this is what it's saying. I said, there's something's got to be wrong with this data you sent. And very calmly, they said to me, well, what currency would you recommend? And I said, boy, that's a strange question after what I just told you. I said, well, it says the Swiss franc. Okay, fine, thank you. And 8 days later, the Civil War began. I began to realize, I mean, after that, we had a client in Saudi Arabia who was a big shipper. He called me and he says, what do you think gold's going to do tomorrow? Iran's going to start attacking shipping in the Gulf. I said, you tell me a war's going to start tomorrow? He says, yeah. What do you think gold's going to do? So I began to realize that if you are going to start a war, you know what you're going to do. So you start moving your money in advance. Just like, you know, we have tensions rising with China. And what has China been doing? They've been selling U.S. treasuries by the billions month after month after month. You don't own the debt and finance the guy you're going to war against. It's just simple as that. And so what happened, where everything kind of went really kind of nuts, I would say, in June of 98, we had a conference in London. I stood up and the model was saying that Russia was going to collapse in about 30 days. And I gave out that forecast, but I didn't realize that somebody from the London Financial Times had snuck in the back of the room. And he then put it on the front page of the London Financial Times that, oh, Armstrong says Russia's going to collapse in about 30 days. We're going to have nukes flying around or whatever. And that was published June 27th. And then by September, it fell. And that was the long-term capital management default and all that stuff. The first time the Fed had to bail out all these banks. And then the bankers blamed me. They said, oh, you know, that I had too much influence because they were bribing everybody. And I, you know, so they thought just simply because it made the London Financial Times, I caused them, you know, to lose all this money. And that started the whole thing against me. But that's also when the CIA came, because a lot of people suspected maybe the CIA was all behind my case as well. I don't know. They did come and they said, look, we've been monitoring you guys. And they wanted me to go to Washington to build this computer for them. And I said, look, you know, it took me 17 years to build this thing. I said, yeah, we'll run any study you want. No problem. All right. And they said, no, we have to own it. And so they kind of looked at it from a national security perspective that they didn't want anybody else with the same information. So I said, sorry, it's not for sale. And that's basically, you know, after that, it's when, like, you know, they say holy hell broke loose. But
for the listener, Martin, like, you know, I've watched your documentary, which came out in 2014, The Forecaster, which I thought was like a really interesting insight into it. And it still shocks me because I was talking about with the brothers, you know, it isn't like you went to jail for 2 months, 6 months, a year, 2 years. It was 7 years. Then you plea deal and then it's another five. It was 12 years in prison. I don't, you know, if you rewind the clock to the 70s to all the way to where you get to at the beginning of 2000, I don't like, did you realize by going against the machine that that's what it would do to you? I mean, there's no way to realize it, but I mean, 12 years.
Not really. I mean, the biggest problem with the entire legal system is that 7 years was civil contempt. Okay. I'm the longest person ever held in contempt of court in history. The statute itself says maximum 18 months. They just kept rolling it. They finally had to release me. Only when the Supreme Court was taking my case and ordered them to explain what the heck was going on. And they couldn't answer, you know, and so they had to release me. So then what they pulled was that, okay, fine, here, just plead to this. And I mean, my plea's online, you can read it. I failed to tell my clients that Republic Bank took the money for its own benefit. I don't even know how that's a crime, honestly. And I was supposed to get time served and walked out. And the judge goes, well, okay, fine. That's another 5 years. So it was clearly that they were just trying to keep me, you know, shut up at that point. And I mean, the shenanigans that went on, they went after my lawyers. So they make the lawyers so they couldn't talk to me. They put me in with the World Trade Center terrorists. I mean, I was in the most secure facility in the country. And my family couldn't even went and they said, oh, well, he's not here. We don't know where he's at. My lawyers had to go to the judge and say, we don't know where he is. The judge orders the government to try and find me. And they said, oh, well we didn't realize we found him down there. And the judge just simply covers it up, says, oh, good job. You found them. How did I get in with all the terrorists? Did I knock on the door and said, could I please come in and play? You know, how do you get into the most secure facility in the country and you don't know I'm there? If you don't know I'm there, then how do you know anybody's in there? I mean, the excuses that these people make up to hide stuff is just, it's endless. People don't realize, I mean, just look at all the wars that they just lie about all the time. Weapons of mass destruction. I mean, it just goes, it's endless. It's endless. there were investigations against FDR that he knew that Pearl Harbor was going to be attacked by the Japanese because they broke the code. But Congress wouldn't approve it were an act of war. So he allowed Pearl Harbor to take place. The Senate investigation just concluded, well, it's inconclusive whether he knew in advance. And that's it. Just go down the list. I mean, it's just crazy. Every war they've lied about for you name it, you know, and they're doing that again.
Did you, before I certainly want to talk about where we're at now and where you think we're at, but, you know, when you talk about prison and being locked up in one of the most secure prisons in the world, I assume you had a lot of time to think. Did you figure anything out while you were sitting behind bars?
Basically, you're in the belly of the beast and you get to see what it's really like. The shenanigans are just mind-boggling. I mean, I was in one cell with one of the terrorist guys, and they come by and they say, all right, fine, we're going to do laundry. Take off all your clothes, because they know a Muslim can't be seen naked. And then they say, oh, well, somebody's coming with more clothes, and they never do. Then there's no heat. You can see your breath, basically. And then they tell them, oh, the blankets are made from pig hair. I told the guy, put the blanket on. It's not pig hair. It's wool. Don't listen to these people. I mean, he's sitting there shivering. I mean, this is the stuff that these people do. It's mind-boggling. I mean, like Epstein supposedly committed, you know.
I don't think anybody believes that.
There's no way you can hang yourself in one of these cells. Then, you know, that's where suicides, you know, they know they have people come by every hour looking, because that's where people do commit suicide, but not by hanging.
Did you ever, once again, I've had different people on here, you know, like Tamara Leach was one of the ladies who went to jail for the Freedom Convoy out in Ottawa in 2022. And she spent, I think it's 48 days locked up for her part in that. Mm-hmm. And I just had a guy actually a couple weeks ago in Quebec, 108 days for not putting on a mask in a courthouse. And he was basically wouldn't come out to their terms. So they just left him in the prison. In your stint, which isn't a stint, like, man, you spent more time than convicted felons get. Like everybody, it seems, gets to plead here in Canada. It's pretty crazy how short of terms people get for some serious crimes. Did you think you were getting out, or were you like, I may never get out of this place ever?
Now, at a point, you basically don't think you're ever getting out, really, because it's just time and time again. It's just, you know. It's just a bunch of lies. My lawyers even warned me. He said, look, you know, they will probably try and kill you. And they did. You know, I ended up in the, to their dismay, I mean, I ended up having to go to the hospital. I was in a coma. But I survived. I came out. And so then it was like, so it was just, I mean, they pull every trick in the book. And so, I mean, it was, that's why I've done this book, The Plot to Seize Russia. And with all the declassified documents I finally got from the Clinton administration, I mean, this is basically what it's been, I think what they've been hiding. They've been trying to take over Russia for decades. And like I said, I was in the middle of this stuff. The propaganda against Putin is absolutely outrageous. Putin is the moderate guy. You remove Putin and we got a real problem, because the hardliners are right behind him. They're the ones threatening nuclear war all the time. And, you know, these people just lie about absolutely everything. But this is a war to... all they've ever wanted to do. I mean, Ron Paul even came out and said that these neocons have been waging endless wars for 30 years and never won a single one of them.
You, one of the things, you know, when I rewind back to 2020, the first time I ever heard you speak, is you mentioned a year And it has been in my brain ever since. But at the time, I was like, that's like 12 years away. Why would I? And, you know, in fairness, back then, Sean thought in maybe terms of months, maybe a year, but nothing longer than that. And I think most people can sympathize with three young kids under four. It was a busy time. Now, as I get just a smidge older and have been through everything that we've been through as humanity, honestly, the date seems a lot closer than I would have ever thought. And that's 2032. Mm-hmm. You know, in your paper you wrote on Canada at the I think February, you quote me on the month, Marty. You mentioned the Great Reset equals 2032. And then you go on to say, you know, the cycles of the 8.6 into all the different numbers, they all culminate in 2032. Mm-hmm. So I guess I have a two-part. Well, I just want to talk about 2032 maybe to start. What is it about 2032 that seems to be this year that things are all going to collide into?
Well, I should explain. my nemesis is Klaus Schwab.
Well, you've just created fans of my entire show because I think all of our nemesis is Klaus Schwab.
Well, we created our first World Economic Conference, and actually Michael had came down to it in 1985. And before then, I would be running up and doing like a small conference for institutions like in Toronto, Vancouver, Zurich, etc. And I remember I was doing one in Zurich and people from Canada flew over for that. And they said, you should really just have one where we all can get together. I said, gee, that's an idea. So we did that in 85. And it was kind of like a mini UN. I mean, there were guys in there with white robes from Saudi Arabia. I mean, everybody was there. It was very interesting. And so Klaus Schwab then started his World Economic Forum. His first big event was 1987. That movie you mentioned that was done on me, The Forecaster, was done by Marcus Vetter. It was funded by a German TV station. Schwab paid him directly to do a movie on him called The Forum. Our, you know, date of 2032 is what he has taken and calls it the Great Reset. What he's trying to do is what our forecast is that's when Republican forms of government basically collapse. And we get to redesign our government, the same similar like, you know, the American Revolution was against monarchy. And then we got to restart a new form of government. This is what will happen. Society goes through these events all the time. And if that was not true, we'd still all be speaking Babylonian, you know. So Schwab understands what our model's forecasting. And what he's trying to do is make sure it pushes in his direction of totalitarianism. And George Soros, look, I've, you know, as a hedge fund manager, I traded against him, Buffett, we traded head to head. I mean, I cost Soros over $1 billion when he was trying to manipulate the Japanese yen. So, I mean, it's a small world. We all kind of know each other. And, you know, so this is basically it. When Soros was going after the British pound, which made him all this money, I had been advising Margaret Thatcher, and they staged a coup to get her out because they wanted to take the pound into the euro, and she was against it, and I was against it. And so when Soros was started shorting the pound in the European rate mechanism, which was the prelude to the euro, they were forced to call me. And I said, look, I said, you overvalued the pound. You have to devalue the pound. And they said, we can't. John Major ran on election and promised not to devalue the pound. I said, well, you know, unless you got about 10 billion pounds every day for, you know, indefinitely for weeks, you're not going to be able to defeat this. So I wrote a paragraph, gave it to him. I said, look, have them say we're going to allow the pound to float to seek its own level. And they said, oh, brilliant. Okay, because it's not actually him devaluing. So that was the collapse in the pound. Soros made a ton of money out of it. But there was no other way out of it, really. So we all know each other, I mean, very closely. So a lot of people thought Soros was also behind my imprisonment. And, you know, they all probably were to some degree because they felt that I was always their nemesis. And I would say it's going to collapse and they would lose money and run to the government with a handout. But so 2032 is the collapse of Republican forms of government. And what these people are trying to do, Soros in particular, has this open society nonsense. And he believes in a one world government. And you can go to my site, armstrongeconomics.com, and search the French president, Holland. I have a video that I put on there of him standing there in Parliament alongside of Merkel saying precisely that, that the whole reason behind creating the euro in the EU was to prevent European war. That a single government, their theory is, that ends war. And I told them, I said, look, Rome had a single government. How many civil wars did they end up with? You know, you can't put, you know, one policy to everybody. And it's just absurd. I mean, you take Ukraine, what you know, Zelensky's done to the Donbass, outlawed their language and outlawed their religion. What would happen in Canada if they all said, okay, Quebec, you can no longer speak French, you have to speak English. And by the way, you could be in a civil war too, you know. Let's just be practical about this stuff. I mean, it's personally, I think they deliberately are doing this to create war. But, you know, that's just the way things go with these people. But that's where we're headed. Schwab is just trying to push it in his direction. And my computer says basically they will fail. You know, I've also been an advisor to so many different governments. Communism fell largely because it was dehumanizing. It didn't matter, you know, what your talent was. We need somebody to push a broom over here. You're next in line. Go. And I was actually summoned in by China when, you know, China was trying to go capitalist. So I was invited over. I flew over to meet the central bank. They took me to a facility, and you would have thought I was a head of state in a motorcade and everything else. This facility had hundreds of people in it, and they were all downloading the internet, from the internet, everything they could find. And with the Chinese, I will say they were substantially different from the Russians. Stalin was very paranoid. So he was concerned about what everybody thought. And if he thought you had any inclination for a revolution, you were sent off to the gulag and killed, basically. In China, they were not really concerned about that, but it was more of what you call the tall poppy syndrome. Stick your head up and it will be cut off. So the difference was they did not really destroy, you, I would say, humanity as the Russians did. The Russians even wanted to destroy the family unit, that they told the children that your biological parents are not really yours. It's the state that takes care of you, that sort of thing. And in fact, I knew somebody that grew up in East Germany. When the wall fell, his father went down and got his Stasi file. And here, everybody he thought was a friend was reporting on him. And he came back and started punching holes in the walls. And my friend thought his father was nuts. And now he's pulling microphones. It was that intense. And so when I was taken to this facility in China, I was taken into this room and they were monitoring absolutely everything. They had 249 varieties of tea that they were tracking. But unlike the Russians, they were not interfering. They were letting it all just take place. And so I was there and I was having to deal with questions that were very fascinating. They were asking me, like, there were 249 varieties of tea. Why is this one tea selling for a lot more over here than over there? I said, well, where is it coming from? Well, here, I said, first you have transportation costs. Oh, really? I said, yes. Okay. I said, secondly, I mean, somebody will pay more for something if they like this one better than that one. Whereas under communism, if it was a dollar here, it had to be a dollar over there, even if it cost you $10 to get it there. That's why it fell, totally inefficient. And that's the whole problem with socialism. There are different costs and there, we all have different talents and you know, it certainly will cost less to manufacture something where everybody is living, if it's Toronto or Vancouver, than to truck it all the way up to Edmonton. There's going to be a cost to do that. You know, in communism, that was never taken into account. So it was very fascinating. I learned a lot over the years from having to deal with the different governments and all different sides. And it's just been an interesting 40 years, I would say.
Well, I would say 40 years that are very interesting, sir. When you look at Ken, you bring up China and what they're tracking and everything else. I don't know, from just a minion out here in the West, I look at our leader, and he seems to enjoy the Chinese model, and that's Justin Trudeau I'm talking about. But when you sit and look at Canada, what does Socrates show you for the coming years in between here and 2032, or what are you seeing coming down the pipe?
Well, Canada will break apart more or less the West against the East, the same as the United States is going to break apart as well, and so is Europe. You have different cultures, and you know, you have, you know, Trudeau basically following this nonsense of climate change, etc., which you know, the climate has always changed. I mean, you know, they forgot there were ice ages in school and warming periods, etc. How did we ever warm up without soccer moms driving SUVs to, you know, around, you know? This is just the way it is. There's a cycle to absolutely everything. And in all honesty, it's the warming periods that when civilization expands. When you go into the cold periods, that's where we lose 50% of the population, et cetera, because of several factors. One is that when there is global cooling, crops fail. And you also, when they fail, basically disease rises. So there's correlations between this stuff. I mean, it's simple as that. There's also correlations for global warming from the sun beats like your heart. These people, you know, in all forms of analysis, not just climate change, economics, you name it, they assume it's linear. So if it went up, you know, a half a degree today, oh my God, we'll calculate that out for the next 50 years and we're all going to be dead. It doesn't work that way. Nothing works that way. Does the stock market go up every year without ever going down? I mean, there's a cycle to absolutely everything. And there's even generational cycles that that we go through. I mean, we do not necessarily always end up in the same place or in agreeing with our parents. So, you know, I mean, you had my father grew up from the Great Depression. And so he was like against trading. Oh, that was evil. That's what caused the Depression, et cetera. So he didn't want to see me go into trading. You know, that's his experience, and that's what he came out with it from. And so we go through these periods and you could read them. Even Cicero talking about pollution back in Rome because they were burning wood. The first Clean Air Act was 561 AD under the Emperor Justinian, you know, and so, I mean, these things there's nothing new. I mean, you know, if you look at it objectively, you'll see everything is always repeats. So they were burning wood for fuel back then. So we burn fossil fuels. I mean, you know, this idea that you're going to be able to eliminate CO2, I mean, it's not realistic.
When I look at 2032 and do the math, roughly 8.6 years puts us awfully close here I don't know where that puts us in the cycle, but it puts us awfully close to 2023. If my math is correct, Martin.
2024.
do you see, you know, like there's a ton of heat going on right now with Ukraine, Russia, and, you know, this nuclear power plant and different things. Does Socrates predict war with NATO? And I don't know how it breaks it down, but like, are we going to see World War III? Is that, you know, you mentioned breakup of Canada, the breakup of the United States. I don't know. Do you have any insight on that?
Yes. I mean, our computer is showing that we'll end up in what will be international war. Most likely starting from 25 into probably 27, 28. I mean, you can't bash all these, you know, people. And I mean, nobody seems to be interested in peace. I mean, peace in Ukraine would be very simple. I mean, people don't realize, you know, all this propaganda, Zelensky, oh, we're fighting for democracy. No, he's not. The Minsk agreement was supposed to allow the Donbass the right to vote. All right. And they're denying that, refused to allow them to separate or vote. And people have to understand, right up to the river where Kiev is on, that used to be Russia of the Tsars. Okay, so this is why so many Russian people are there. You know, they've been there for centuries. Ukrainians, you know, it's really a land grab at this point. And we had two Ukrainian employees, one from Kiev and one from Donetsk, and both of them are hiding out now in Berlin. I mean, if you're really trying to care about your country, he should have sought peace from the beginning. He ran on elections promising peace. That's what they voted for. And then they get exactly the opposite. And honestly, I think he's just taking money from others that just profit from war. And I mean, he stands up and says, oh, Ukraine's going to be the biggest investment for Europe ever. All the money coming in that's going to come in from BlackRock. And this is what he's looking. So, yeah, okay, fine. Destroy everybody's house, and then we get to rebuild it like we did in Iraq. I don't think that's a very good solution. I mean, over 8 million people, almost, you know, more than a third of his population have fled the country. I don't see where this benefits Ukraine at all. I mean, the Donbass is basically, you know, they're Russians. They've always been Russian. So let them go. I mean, you know, you've got your own country. Why are you destroying it?
One of my, I throw a shout out to Harley. He wanted to ask you you see inflation, deflation, or a mix of both in the years to come?
Well, it will be a mix of both. But I mean, initially, our model was projecting inflation all the way into 24. And it's important to understand that that was set in motion by the COVID nonsense. And why I call it nonsense is that I was actually given the program from a deep source in Britain, was asked to review the program that this guy Ferguson used, which was funded by Bill Gates, to justify the lockdowns. I mean, I wrote a piece on it, and I said, this is absolutely unbelievable. It's like a 1970s child's program. And in the instructions, it said, run it several times and then average the outcome. I mean, it was more like a child's game of SimCity, basically, is what I told them. And they just wanted to lock down the world as the first exercise in power. And they intend to use this for climate change as well. But by locking us down, they cut off the supply chain. And, you know, I got plenty of emails from farmers that had to kill 30,000 chickens because they couldn't get them to market. And this is what caused the inflation. The inflation in this cycle was because of shortages, not speculation. So, I mean, even still to this day, I go, you know, shopping, and sometimes that one thing is just not there anymore. And you got to come back the next day. So what do you do? Well, when it is there, you buy extra because it might not be there the next time. And so this kind of inflation is not going to be prevented by raising interest rates. That only makes it worse. But the central banks, the only thing they have is the interest rate to play with. So it basically makes the whole crisis even worse. But so then you add war to it. And war is always inflationary. So you have to understand that. And it's, it is, yeah.
That's a great.
That's somebody from the office calling. Yeah, sorry about that, but
that's great. That's a great ringtone right there.
Well, I have two phones, so
you know, if people are wondering what Marty Armstrong's ringtone is, there you have it.
That's the company phone. So I know that's the company phone versus my personal one, but you know, this is basically what you have to look at. It's the inflationary cycle that we have is set in motion by the COVID shortages. And then all this money being dumped into Ukraine, war is the most inflationary aspect that there is. I mean, that's, you know, the Vietnam War broke, you know, Bretton Woods. And this is what even Powell said. If people, you know, have to understand that a central bank cannot come out and outright say, look, you dumb people, you're causing a real problem here. But if you look at Powell's speech, at the end, he says, and international considerations. So he's basically telling them, you keep spending on this war, and that's going to be inflationary, and I'm going to have to raise interest rates. That's what he's telling them. But he's not going to come out and say, look, you people are causing this inflation because of this. And he's not going to come out and criticize them and say, you caused this whole inflationary cycle with COVID. You know, they just, that's just simply the way it is. I mean, I got called into the 1987 presidential, you know, commission on investigating that crash. And I told them, look, you set this in motion because of G5 up there telling people you wanted to see the dollar down by 40%. So if you read the end paragraph, basically, of the Brady Commission report, the best that they could say is, well, we think foreign exchange had something to do with it. That's it. they can't come out and say, look, we caused it. There's never going to be, you know, I say basically, no matter what government you go to, there's no mirrors there because they never see it. It's them. It's always us.
Oh, man, that's a great way to put it. With a few minutes left, Marty, I was wondering, you said they intend to use it for climate change as well, and you were talking about their totalitarian lockdowns, that type of thing. Does a model show that coming here in the next, 9 years, essentially?
I mean, look, they're doing the lockdowns probably also because they are – most of these governments are also aware of our model, and it shows rising civil unrest, wars coming. They know that. And I think the climate, nonsense is all about justifying lockdowns. And if you lock everybody down, you prevent people from traveling, then they think they're protecting themselves against any kind of a revolution or civil unrest. Particularly Europe was doing that. I mean, that you couldn't fly even between countries. And that was to prevent anybody coming in and joining like the riots in France. This whole thing is just falling apart. The more they try to squeeze the lifeblood out of society, the more people will revolt against it. And you're going to see what you're seeing in France is not really that unusual.
Well, I appreciate you giving me some time. Here's the final question. It's the last question of the podcast. It's a Crude Master final question. It's if you stand behind a cause, then stand behind it absolutely. What's one thing Marty stands behind?
basically, I would have to say that. They say the first casualty in war is always truth. And they have expanded that to government. There is nothing whatsoever that they say that can be trusted. That's why they're shutting people down. They're doing everything they can to knock that off. It ends up being basically a period in time which they know is coming where people are just simply going to rise up against government for various reasons, but on a global scale.
Well, I appreciate you giving me some of your time today. It has been, I joked about this, but I had a list of 10 people I wanted to get on here at the start of the year. And I put your name in that list and thinking, maybe it can happen, certainly didn't know who you were a couple of years ago. Now follow avidly your posts and your thoughts and everything else. I know the brothers as well do. And I just appreciate you coming on. I hope we can get you on again in the future because it's been a very enjoyable hour on this side. And thanks again for just giving me some time.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's always a pleasure. All we can do is hope to educate everybody we can.
Hey, thanks for tuning in today, guys. I hope you enjoyed Marty Armstrong. I hope you took something out of that. Oh, man. I look forward to hearing your text. I'm now officially, as of today, that's not quite true. I'm in Irma for a golf tournament. Then I got my brother's 40th birthday. And then we head south to Mel's parents. So this is officially... in my mind, I'm heading on holidays. So I appreciate, all you guys kicking around. No worries, the podcast ain't going anywhere. We got a few that have been saved up for just such a time. And look forward to hearing your thoughts as the weeks progress. No worries, there's going to be new content. The Tuesday mashup's still happening. I'm not going anywhere. It's going to be some fun had. I'm just going to be doing it out of Minnesota here for the next month. Today's episode, I should point out, has been brought to you by CalRock Industries. With new, used, and refurbished oil and gas equipment in stock, CalRock is your best bet when it comes to finding equipment that fits your needs, is within your budget, and is ready as soon as you need it. Go to calrock.ca. They got all the info there. And you can, you can get all your oil field equipment here in the Lloydminster area. Cal Rock Industries. Hey, just saying. And, you know, I hope everybody's summer is ticking along. I'm looking forward to being in a car with three young humans and my wife for 3 days in a row. So that should be, you know, it's funny. You would think you would dread those days. And I know some people are like, you guys are going to do what? You're going to drive together. Like, that's crazy. It's like, yeah, we are. And it's funny. Last year we did it for 11 days and they were like the best memories of the entire stinking trip. So let's get on with it, you know. Bring on the screaming, kids. I'm ready. I hope everybody has a great summer. Certainly, I'm no going nowhere. Certainly, I will be around. Certainly, the podcast will be here. But I'm going to try enjoy July as much as I can. And I hope you do as well. Either way, this is me signing off.